glad you took that suggestion. So we had a little meeting this morning among all the AGN people. I just want to reiterate the warning I gave to them there. This should be a very boring talk for those of you in the AGN program, because I'm not going to tell anything that you shouldn't already know. Hopefully putting it all together in this will be interesting, but this is really meant more for the other programs and people who are not in astrophysics. So the main subject of this is in some sense why I'm here, because this is one of my big interests, are black holes and binary black holes in galactic nuclei. So the GN, the AGN. First question, if I'm going to give a talk like this, which I feel is important to address, particularly if I'm not speaking to those who have already been converted, why do we care? And so I'm sure everyone has their own private reasons for caring. Let me point out, I sort of come at this with two different hats. And so let me tell you about the two hats I wear when I talk about why I'm interested in black holes at the cores of galaxies. So first of all, thinking about it as a physicist. This really gets to the cool bleep. Okay, why do we care about these things? Basically, I mean, I got into this game because I just think black holes are cool objects. More specifically, what's cool about them is that black holes are incredibly simple. As I will outline in a little more detail further into the talk, these are macroscopic objects, okay, objects that are far larger than, you know, masses of stars or many, many millions of stars that are fully characterized by a really small set of numbers. Only three numbers in principle. And as I'll describe, two really in practice fully characterize a black hole. This is amazing. You have macroscopic objects that have properties that are really like that of elementary particles. Okay? Just a set of numbers that completely describe what are truly macroscopic objects. From the astronomy and the astrophysics view, well, I was originally trained as a general relativity theorist, and so this is sort of my childhood in some sense. This is where I come to this from. What's been really getting me into this in more recent years is that we've come to appreciate now that these objects are ubiquitous. And every time we look at a galaxy, particularly galaxies with central bulges, we always find a black hole. Or, as I will elaborate a little more carefully further in the talk, we see very strong plausibility cases for objects that most likely are black holes. I will sort of back away from that Clinton-esque kind of lawyer language for the introduction, but I'll just say that they exist in all cores of galaxies. Even more than that, though, okay, that's...
Just the same.
Yeah.
For an astrophysicist like myself,
yes.
The evidence is coming from the black sensitivity to be large.
That's exactly what I'm going to get into in a little bit. It's essentially, so at the moment, what we have is an argument. Most of the argument is related to masses. We would really like to do better.
There are no gravitational aberrations or equivalents.
That's a lot of what the game of trying to make the lawyerly language in this that I just laid out, trying to get rid of some of that. Can you come up with plausible alternatives? And in the cases where we have the best data, the alternatives are becoming increasingly less plausible. Okay? But I might as well say this right now. The number of cases where we have an absolute airtight case of the existence of a black hole, something that we have absolutely no doubt this is a black hole described by general relativity, is currently precisely zero. Okay. However, in those cases, the alternatives are in some sense even weirder.
Including our own galaxy
as one of those. Yeah, and I will outline that a little bit. One thing that's particularly interesting about all, what, from the astrophysics point of view, what is particularly interesting about work that has shown that these things exist in the cores of all galaxies is that very recently we've also seen that the properties, particularly the masses of the black holes, is tightly coupled to the properties of the galaxy in which it resides. Particularly the galaxy's bulge. Okay, so if we look at many galaxies, you see a central region. Many galaxies are disc like with beautiful spiral arms, but you see a big puffed out center. It's almost quasi-spherical. And the black hole's properties appear to be very tightly correlated with the black hole's masses, rather, tightly correlated with the properties of that central bulge. And what's amazing about this is if I tell you that a black hole has a certain mass, you can then tell me, okay, given that this mass is embedded in some gigantic spherical mass of stars, its gravitational interactions should have a radius of influence that is some number you can calculate. What we see are that the properties of the bulge are correlated to the properties of the black hole well beyond where the black hole has any influence. Okay? That was a very surprising fact. I think when this was first deduced, it made a lot of people stand up and kind of go, huh, what could possibly do that? What this seems to imply is that black holes and galaxies, we know that they have grown over cosmic time. And what this is telling us is that the mechanism by which galaxies grow is very tightly coupled to the mechanisms by which black holes grow. And that is one of the themes of what we're doing in this program, is exploring questions related to this. So, for the non-specialists in the audience, let me go back to ground zero and begin with the physicist's viewpoint. What is a black hole, really? Okay? Now, many of us are familiar with a definition that I know in my case, I really first learned in elementary school. It's an object with gravity so strong that not even light can escape. Okay? And that's not a bad ballpark definition. I want to give a definition that's a little bit more precise. Okay? Because this precise definition is going to tie into whether these objects that we observe are in fact really black holes or not, and really ties into many of the tests we're trying to do to probe this. So, a more precise definition is that this is a region of space-time that is causally disconnected from the rest of the universe. Okay? So by causally disconnected, that means that there is a region of space-time, we'll call this the interior of our black hole, that can have no causal influence on anything outside of us. And we call the boundary that defines which region is in fact causally disconnected the event horizon. So anything on the inside of this boundary can have no impact on what's going on the outside.
Is there more to that definition? I mean, why is my forward like a black hole?
Right. The point is, it's a global definition. Okay? So, actually, let me get into this, because light cones are, in fact, what we use to define... Let me just elaborate a little bit more, because light cones are, in fact, exactly the tools that we use to define causality. Okay, so leading into this, let me just remind everyone of a couple of key facts. Okay, we all learned many years ago that flat space, the kind of space that we normally know about, has a Euclidean geometry, and so if I have two points that are separated by some differential of displacement, then the distance between these two points is given by this. Okay?
When we talk
about two events in space-time. So this is a spatial distance. If I talk about two events in space-time, I will have the same spatial distance, but they'll now have a separation in time as well. And we essentially just extend Pythagorean theorem, but we add a minus sign for the time-like component. Okay, that's part of a special relativity that comes out of the properties of the Lorentz group. And what we will normally do is choose units where c equals 1. Okay, so what this tells me if I consider the way light propagates, light propagates on trajectories which give me ds equals 0. Okay. So let's imagine I'm going to choose a trajectory. I'm going to orient my coordinates such that, say, my light is moving spatially along the x-axis. And I ask, if I let a flash of light go out, what does it look like on a space-time diagram? And this gets to exactly the point you were just raising a second ago. This defines a light cone. So a flash of light goes off like this. And choosing my units such that c equals 1, okay, I end up with these two rays that define where light is going to go. Now the point is that everything in here is in causal contact. Okay? I can also define a past light cone. That would be the way things go into the past. So everything contained within the light cone can have a causal influence on other points within the light cone. Okay? And so the point is that at any point in this particular space-time, I can always find there will be some points that are out of causal contact with one another, but there is no special region such that I can never find an observer. For instance, if I'm out here at 65 miles in that direction, all I have to do is go back in the past far enough right here, and I can find some observer who will have a causal influence on the person over there 65 miles away. What happens now when general relativity enters the picture? What we learn is that general relativity changes the light cone structure. Okay, so what I want to do is I'm just going to draw the outgoing direction corresponding to a light cone for a particular kind of space-time. So if I look at the first space-time that was later identified as being a black hole, the Schwarzschild space-time, so time versus r. And for the experts in the audience, we all know that there are various games you can play with choosing your coordinates. I'm going to ask you all to just shut up for a few minutes. The main thing which I want to emphasize in this is that if I'm very, very far away, in some sense that I'll make a little bit more precise in a few moments, it looks just like flat space. Okay? It looks just like the solutions you give a special relativity. The outgoing edge of my light cone looks like this. But as I now move, let's call this r equals 0. Okay, so I'm imagining in the Schwarzschild solution, there is something that looks kind of like a mass at r equals 0. Looks a lot like a mass at r equals 0. I'm going to move in closer and closer to this mass and ask what happens to the outer edge of my light cone as I do this. And what you find is it begins to tip up. Okay? So it's not just pointing off at a 45 degree angle like you would have had in special relativity. It tips up. Eventually, it gets to a point where it's perfectly vertical. And then as you move inside that radius, it actually points in. Let me emphasize what this means. Okay? Out here, okay, it was pointing up less and less. But this still meant that if I was an observer sitting right here, I could communicate, in principle, with guys who were way out, very, very far away. But I hit this one special radius where all of a sudden, outgoing direction was no longer outgoing. Okay? This was as outgoing as I could make it. I'm standing here with a flashlight or a laser beam, madly trying to communicate. Help me, help me! And the light is not reaching out to very distant observers. In fact, when I get onto the inside, this outgoing direction inevitably turns around and points in towards r equals zero. That is really the defining characteristic of a black hole, that I've got this particular radius at which my ability to send outgoing messages to distant observers goes away. And this radius right here defines the event horizon.
How do you know what the thing inside the black hole is?
Sorry?
What's happening inside the black hole is configuration.
That's right. What is robust, so what's going on the inside here, the classical prediction is that you have a singularity of infinite mass, of finite mass, but of infinite tidal gravitational force. We know that can't be right, because we're essentially saying that we're taking some finite amount of mass, compressing it to zero size. We're completely ignoring any kind of quantum effects. Quantum gravity of some kind, be it string theory or whatever your religion tells you, that will drive you towards your bias as to how you would describe the black hole interior. Sorry, David. But what does seem to be robust in all this is the existence of an event horizon that causally separates one region from the other. This is what led Roger Penrose to propose what he calls the cosmic sensor hypothesis, which in a nutshell says, who cares what's going on inside? We can't probe it anyway. People are very interested in that.
There is a
deep question. From the standpoint of astrophysics, though, it kind of gives us license to be lazy, because we are really concerned with processes that we observe, and what's going on the inside here is pretty much by definition unobservable.
There is no problem with sending stuff inside the black hole. Right?
That's right, yeah. So you can send stuff inside the black hole, and people who do explore what happens to the singularity, the classical solutions are ones that are in some sense eternal. I'm going to talk about that in just a second. And so people say, well, what happens if I take the solution that's presumed to exist all the way in the infinite past and be unchanging all the way in an infinite future and throw a bunch of stuff down into it? That will change the classical description of what goes on the inside. Well, having established that general relativity has these solutions that have event horizons, I was sitting down thinking about, in some sense, okay, that's nice, that's been known for, it's been known and understood in this kind of modern language since the 1960s, really. A couple questions that drive what you, how seriously you want to take this. So, within general relativity, you may ask then, how many solutions are there with event horizons? In other words, how many black holes can there be? Okay, is this going to be something where it's like a stellar model, where you can have an infinite variety of stars depending upon what goes into it? Or does something more special happen compared to something that's a little simpler? Can these solutions be created by what, for lack of a better term, I will call normal processes? Okay, the kind of solution that led to this thing was, as I just elaborated a second ago, it's something that essentially existed for infinite time, all the way back in the infinite past, and lasts into the infinite future. Finally, the last one is, do these exist in nature? Okay, so let's go through these questions one by one. And the one we're going to end up spending the most time on is number three. So the answer to number one is that there is a single unique solution for a black hole. maybe a little bit cagey about that. For a steady state black hole. But it's one that depends on three parameters. A mass, M, a spin, S, and it's often common in general relativity to renormalize the spin with respect to the mass, and in the kind of units that we prefer to work in, this actually turns out to be a dimensionless number, and you can show that it will only have an event horizon if this number lies in the range from 0 to 1. And then finally, a charge, Q. Okay? This is kind of amazing. This is the only solution that exists. Ah, sure. In principle, yeah. So, you know, maybe some magnetic charge, G. Any other gauge field, you can imagine throwing charges in there as well, but these are the ones. The point is, it's essentially monopole charges, I think is what I'm boiling this down to. In astrophysics, we generally throw this away. Okay? We don't think there's enough magnetic monopoles that we care about that, although it would be cool to be proven wrong. And if it has regular electric charge, well, in astrophysics, these things often live in environments with lots of ionized plasma around, and we expect them to be neutralized fairly quickly. So it's boiled down to a solution that only depends on two numbers, a mass and a spin. Okay? No. A key statement in this theorem. So this result is a rigorously proven theorem, which goes by the stupid name of the no-hair theorem, which many people are now calling the two-hair theorem, because spin are considered to be hair. What goes into this proof, it really relies on this idea that this thing is in steady state. Okay? And what we see is that the mechanism by which this theorem is enforced is I can, using perturbation theory or using numerical simulations, I can create an object that has an event horizon but does not satisfy this solution. And what you find as you sort of put this into your code and say go is that it very quickly, on a short dynamical time scale, relaxes. It may oscillate a little bit. And it's driven down into this steady state solution. What we find is that the event horizon can be regarded as an extremely gooey, viscous membrane that always wants to be driven into this state. And if you try to pull it into some other state, it's kind of like a balloon. It will snap back into the state that it wants to be in. So the mechanism, what you find when you do this, if I take a black hole and add charge to it, but I make it not a monopole, but have some kind of a crazy multipolar distribution, all the multipoles radiate away, leaving only the monopole charge behind. If I take a shape and I distort it, or I give it a really goofy spin distribution, all of those extra multipoles that go beyond just the monopolar mass and the dipolar spin radiate away. This was first proven by Richard Price, known as Price's theorem. And Steve Giddings gave a really great name to this when I was a postdoc here. He called this the balding process. And that's exactly what it is. You take all this extra hair and it just shaves off. This is a purely classical statement, that's right. You end up with, at least in the perturbative limit, the equations that govern this, really just look like, it's almost like a Schrodinger type equation for a wave trapped in some kind of a potential well. And classically, it just all radiates away.
What happens to the
camera? Yeah. And presumably, that's right. Yeah, you're dealing with, at least in astrophysics, you're dealing with masses, which I'll describe in a moment, billions of solar masses. So people tend not to ask that question because the answer is sort of, I don't know, who cares?
Understand.
Right. Right. Okay. I hear an argument developing. Let me move on to answer the second question. Can these solutions be created by normal physical processes? what we're getting at here is, given that these are very special solutions, okay, these are things that exist over all time, going all the way back into the past, can some normal, non-singular, smooth distribution of matter create them? And the answer is yes. Gravitational collapse takes smooth, non-singular, normal matter and forms event horizons. Okay, the first calculation of this actually goes back to 1939. Okay, and this was done by, actually, Robert Oppenheimer. His student, whose first name I don't know. Oppenheimer and Snyder. Sorry?
Hartland
Snyder. I didn't know that. Okay. So this has been known for a long, long time. These guys are doing it in 19... This is actually, it's a fully analytic solution. I assigned this calculation in my general relativity class. And it just relies... The way you can do it analytically is you just simplify the bejesus out of it. You take matter that is very smooth and uniform and actually pressureless. Very natural physical matter. You impose spherical symmetry and you just let it go. But it's very illustrative. And you can actually remove all of these simplifying assumptions numerically. And since then, numerical work has shown that if I use much more realistic matter distribution, something that looks a little more like a star, and I just set it up in such a way that the restoring force cannot oppose gravity, it will form a black hole and you will get event horizons forming. So, for my next one, let me actually, I'm going to show a video, so let this start to come to life. The final thing, the final question here, just turn the leftmost light off. Thanks.
Hey.
Wah! That was not supposed to hang on, I actually wanted the middle one up. So, yeah, the middle one up, just there we go, great, thank you. Okay, so we'll be using that in just a second. So, final thing is, do these exist in nature? Yeah.
Didn't Einstein object to black holes on the ground that he thought he couldn't
make it? So Jim, you may be able to address that. I'm actually not sure what his objections to this were.
I never talked to Einstein about this.
Okay.
So I don't know.
Well, presumably you've read more things than I did. Yeah, so he...
And he did have a paper where he claimed that you couldn't form a black hole, but it was just confused.
Okay. What's that? Yeah, a lot of people said it was ridiculous. Well, I mean, you know, one of the people who really set this field back by decades was Eddington. People had their biases. They'll continue to have the biases. What's that?
They also didn't understand what they were really talking about.
Right. Isn't it great how we can badmouth all these dead people? Anyhow. So the final question I want to address then is, do these objects actually exist in nature? And my answer, as I sort of elaborated at the beginning, is kind of like, you know, some of our modern Major League Baseball records. It's yes, but with an asterisk. Because what we can say is that there are definitely objects that are massive and really compact. So much so that alternatives to the black hole hypothesis are actually less plausible than a black hole. The strongest example of this, the best case for this, is the object at the center of the Milky Way. And I'm going to be showing some data that comes from the group that is run by Andrea Ghez at UCLA and some stuff from Reinhard Genzel at the Max Planck Institute. Which one is he at, actually? Is it MPE or MPA? MPE, so Max Planck Institute for Extraterrestrial Physics. One thing that I really need to emphasize is in astrophysics, pretty much all of our quantum leaps in understanding really come from improved instrumentation.
What I want to show you is
this is what has really driven our deep understanding of things going on at the center of our galaxy has been the
introduction of
adaptive optics. Essentially, technology that allows us to deform the mirrors of telescopes to compensate for noise due to atmospheric fluctuations. So this view here is this is what the galactic center looks like if you do not use adaptive optics. Now correcting for atmospheric aberrations, what we see is what was originally just sort of a uniform field of light in the central square arc second, stars just pop out. This is what the technology has allowed us to resolve, which 15 years ago, you know, this region that we were looking at, it was nothing. And these stars that have resolved into here have told us an amazing story. So what we've been able to do, what these groups I'm stealing, have been able to do by observing these sources at the galactic center is construct the orbits of stars. So something big is where this star is located. All the other objects are actual stars, real stars that are orbiting that something big.
What's the time scale?
So the time scale, you probably can't see it all the way over there, unfortunately. This clock runs from
1996,
so 1995. So what it does is, it's a little better than that. It pauses today, and then it extrapolates from this view to what these orbits, how they are expected to observe. Okay, so these things are, you actually don't really need general relativity to describe these orbits. These are all relatively weak field orbits, although it's noting. This one that comes in here and turns around, it's believed to pass within 90 astronomical units of the object at the core of the galaxy. So for those of you who don't know stellar astronomical units, Earth to the Sun is one astronomical unit. And so this is basically coming as close to this massive object as...
All the orbits turn around the center?
Yes. That is what is seen. So there's only a few that have actually turned around. This one is going to complete in about five or six years. That'll be the first one to actually close its ellipse. But all the other ones, we can observe, you know, we should see them eventually. The event horizon at that distance is about...
0.1?
Yeah, it's a little smaller than that. It's 0.01, I think. Between 0.01 and 0.03, something like that. It's still a factor of 1,000 from the Schwarzschild radius of the black hole. We would love to be able to probe even deeper, but this was a hell of an achievement already.
What's the speed of these suns?
This one, when it turns around, is moving at about 5,000 kilometers per second. Okay, but we can, because of this, let me go to my next video. We can study that spectrum. We get the radial velocity from these things. We see it projected on the sky. We also get radial velocity information from the Doppler shifting of their spectral lines. And that's allowed people to construct the full 3D shape of their orbits. So this is the group at the Max Planck Institute. Essentially, largely similar data. They're a competing collaboration. But what they show in this thing is that we can sort of make our camera go around this entire entourage of orbits here. And we see how all these things have been constructed.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
You must have calculated this. How long do we have to wait on average until that black hole beats one of those stars?
Actually, I'm going to defer that question to, is Kristen Manu here? Kristen, you've done some work on tidal capture of stars. Okay.
It's a difficult calculation.
I mean, these stars could, in principle...
No, but yeah. Other stars that aren't...
That's right. I mean, the numbers that typically get thrown around are on the order of every 100,000 of every million years or so.
No.
Something like that would happen. But does anyone from the program give me something a little more accurate on this? So,
are there other stars in that field that are dimmer and harder to see?
Presumably, yes. In fact, that's actually one of the sources of error in this thing, is that you have actually some background stars that these things pass in front of. And they are not bound to the black hole, but their light is in there, and that's, you have to take that into account when you're reducing the data.
Are these stars all on the same type, or sequence, or
Okay, you're now asking questions which are... They are massive main sequence stars, but they're actually, I mean, it is somewhat sort of mysterious how they got there, because this is, because of the black hole being there, okay, this is a very tidally deformed region of the center of the galaxy, it's very hard for stars to form. So these things were, seem to have been brought in somehow. That's another one of the mysteries that people are working on.
They seem young.
That's right, and yeah, as a consequence, that's right, they seem very young. Andrea Ghez likes to call this the Botox problem, that these things are, they look younger than they should be. The punchline of all this, yeah, she's at UCLA, so that's why this name makes perfect sense to her. Let me just give you the punchline of this analysis is that that object at the core there is that there is something that has a mass that last I heard, so this number actually is subject to revision from time to time, because what we measure are angular scales, and to convert those measurements of the orbits, what you want to do is use Kepler's law, right? And so you actually need a distance, and so you have to know the distance to the black center in order to get the mass out, and that's actually been subject to revision once or twice, or more than that, and so this number fluctuates around a little bit. It's in the ballpark of 3 to 4 million solar masses. And it's also now known that that central gravitating source has a size that is less than about one astronomical unit. In other words, the radius of the Earth's orbit. That's known because this is also seen as a radio. So the central object is seen as it glows in radio. And people can now resolve what the size of that thing is. There is some gas that's accreting onto it. It's very low luminosity. No, actually, so I just remember seeing the number when the paper appeared in Nature. I don't remember how this was actually determined. But I think it's just actually from measuring, it's a VLB, it's a long baseline interferometry radio measurement. And so I think they actually just determined the angular size of the source and inferred from that what the physical size would be. So it's a very small, very point-like radio source. And just from measuring the size of that radio source, I believe this number, I believe that's where this number comes from. So let me try to wrap things up here fairly quickly. The case for the black holes in our galaxy is a very strong one at this point, because this, you know, people can come up with other hypotheses for these things, but they're getting more and more contrived. Next thing, the natural thing to ask is, what about other galaxies? So for a long time, actually, other galaxies were the best cases. We have observed many objects, quasars and other forms of what are called active galactic nuclei, the AGN. In which there is a small central region that is more luminous than all the other stars in the galaxy. Okay, and if you ask, how can you get something that is that luminous? Okay, you really can't do it by nuclear burning. You have to ask yourself, what processes can give rise to radiative efficiencies such that you can actually make something that luminous? Infall onto a strong gravitational source was the only thing that was plausible. And so this was suggested as the mechanism by which these things were powered in 1964 by Paul Peter and Zeldovich.
What fractions of galaxies have these AGNs?
Sorry?
What fraction of galaxies?
So that's a question that actually, it's a good question because it ties into the next mystery which I'm going to come to. If you look at
high redshift,
okay, if you go back in cosmic time, objects that we see as quasars were relatively common. Something like a percent or a couple percent, I guess, of all galaxies appear to be quasars. So, but as you move nearer and nearer to our current epoch, the number gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And today we see something more like, it's less than a percent of all galaxies show galactic activity like this. So, Sorry?
What's the temperature of these luminous compact regions?
I couldn't quite hear.
Are they black bodies?
No, they're not
black bodies.
It's a lot of modeling that goes into explaining what these things are. There definitely are thermal components, but a lot of them actually have jets that form, which are presumed to be what's going on, is that the black hole has some spin, which is essentially that drags the entire space-time to co-rotate with this thing, and that causes things like magnetic fields to shear and to create collimated jet-like structures, and so you see all sorts of relativistic particles moving along the jets. What goes into these estimates of these calculations of luminosities is actually very complicated because their spectra they're really not thermal. But one reason why these guys suggested this is that by infall onto a compact object, you can get really high efficiency. So it's easy. The maximum efficiency, although following today's discussion, I'm going to have to add an asterisk to this, has often been thought to be you can get about 40% of the rest mass of a particle to come out in radiation, at least as a maximum. And that requires a lot of contrived parameter choices, but getting 10 or 15% doesn't seem to be so difficult. And as we were talking in our discussion today, perhaps you can do even more. But the real mystery here, as gets to Tony's question, is why do we see so many of these things at earlier cosmic times and so few of them today? What's been going on here? And so the hypothesis was what might be going on is that quasars, essentially every galaxy was a quasar, but then it turned off when the fuel, which is the stuff that infalls onto that black hole, ran out. So, for lack of a better term, let's call them modern galaxies. Are the fossils of what were quasars. So that makes a prediction, which is that essentially all galaxies should have black holes in them. So that has driven, this is one thing that drove astronomical campaigns to try to locate these black holes in galaxies. And the way you do it is essentially by the same way that we measure the mass of the black hole in the center of the Milky Way, you look for orbital motion in the core of distant galaxies. This gets into the problem that you really need to resolve in order to actually see something where if you want to observe orbits well enough that you can measure a mass out of it, you have to resolve incredibly small angle. So this really only began to pick up when the Hubble Space Telescope flew. As David Merritt did a lot of work on, there were some previous estimates of these things which weren't all that reliable because they weren't resolving the region of influence of the black hole very well. But what has been going on past, I'm going to wrap this up quickly now, past 10 years or so, has been a concerted campaign to try to measure black holes in the cores of as many galaxies as possible. And so people have done this, and they've created catalogs of black hole masses, and you then ask, well, is there any connection between the mass of the black hole that you measure and the properties of the galaxy? And people have tried lots of possible things that black hole mass could connect to. But what a lot of this discussion was really driving at, what you would like to do, is find some kind of a connection between this massive compact object at the core of the galaxy's central bulge and the gravitational potential of that bulge. And so it turns out that the quantity that was most interesting to look at is a connection between the mass of the black hole and a velocity dispersion. Okay, so these bulges, you can kind of think of them as being, they're self-supported, or they're spheres in which they are self-gravitating. So if you look at the motion of any individual, the stars all kind of have random motions, or they're randomly oriented back to one another. But there is a particular mean velocity. There's a distribution of velocity that these things describe. And so there's a particular dispersion that you can measure, which you can kind of think of as being sort of a mean velocity of these things. And so what work by two competing groups who, one of whom is represented by David Merritt, one of the co-organizers of this group, another one that was at least the papers lead author was Carl Gebhardt at the University of Texas. What they found was that the mass of the black hole and the velocity dispersion had an incredibly tight relationship when we plotted one versus the other. And what they found was that this ended up being, and David, you can correct any of these numbers. I know these things have evolved a little bit with time, but ballpark, you find that the mass of the black hole obeys a power law that looks something like this. What's amazing about this, this is the thing that sort of blew me away once I finally appreciated it, is that if you ask where is the sigma actually measured, this is measured way far out from the black hole, where the black hole has absolutely no business influencing the galaxy at all. Okay? If I have some object with velocity, some particular scale, velocity scale sigma, yes, this is seen only in relatively nearby ones, because those are the only ones where we can actually measure these masses very well. That's an important point. But if I have a black hole with a mass of m, and I see things moving around it with some velocity sigma, then I know that that thing the only objects that will be bound to the black hole will be those inside a radius of influence. And the radius of influence, you can quickly calculate, looks like this. Okay.
People understand why some galaxies have bulges and others don't. Just accidents of formation. Or
it's related to the formation history. I will conclude this actually by showing a video that helps illustrate some of these processes. I will wrap up with that. What this tells me, so if I plug in these numbers, this radius of influence is something like a few tens of light years, and this thing is measured hundreds and thousands of light years away from the black hole. So somehow this bulge
knows about the black hole.
The black hole knows about the bulge, even though they should have no influence on one another whatsoever. And so that brings me to what I'm not going to be able to talk about in too much detail, I'm afraid, but the final part of this is binaries. Okay? How do black holes and galaxies grow? And
the answer is
they grow through merger processes.
So the black hole is not influenced by the gravitational?
Because there's other things around it. So if I imagine, for instance, I have this thing, it's at the core of a cluster, and if I'm really close to it, it is the most important gravitational mass near it, right? But imagine, just for the sake of argument, that this cluster had uniform mass density. If I go out to larger and larger radii, okay, I have a, say, 10 million solar mass black hole at the core of this thing, my orbit is now influenced by the trillions of solar masses of stars, or billions, say, of solar masses of stars that are inside my orbit. And so the black hole is a tiny perturbation on that. That's right, sorry. So yeah, the mass scales that we're dealing with, thank you, David.
10 light years away from a black hole, you have more than 10 to the 8 solar masses.
Thousands of solar masses. So give you an example, when we look at these orbits in the core of the galaxy, those were on radii of light days. Okay? And so as I move farther and farther out, I'm picking up enough stars that I'm completely swamping the mass of the black hole itself. So if I'm 100 light years away, I might have a billion solar masses worth of stars in there. It's going to completely swamp what the black hole is doing. So let me just show a couple more animations to demonstrate one thing that's kind of, well, essentially what we now think is that this relationship is telling us that the black hole, the growth of the black hole in the galaxy are tightly coupled to one another. So let me just show you a little bit about what we now know about the growth of structure in the universe. So this, I'm going to show you an animation by Volker Stringel. So what this shows, we start out at very early cosmic times with some density. What this is showing is the density of dark matter. Okay, we're actually not showing the baryons here, the things that we are made out of, because they're so uninteresting. They don't really actually do a whole lot. And what we see is that over time, all these little lumps are all smacking into one another, and they're forming really clumpy structures. Structure grows because of these merger processes. And so as every one of these little dark matter halos comes together and forms a bigger one, galaxies are coming along for the ride. They're coming along for the ride, and they are merging with one another. The kind of, and this will answer your question, Tony, the kind of interactions that happen when the galaxies actually hit, they look like this. So I start out here with a disk-like galaxy. And this is embedded in one of those halos that was collapsing, or that was colliding in the previous video. The second one comes in. You see they sort of pass through one another. They then remain bound. They come together. And you'll notice that as they did this, they actually form something that's a lot more puffed out. And I wish that thing would actually stay up there. Yeah, put that up again. They form something that's a lot more puffed out. And actually that kind of creates the bulge. Okay? And I think you can almost think of it as just kind of, it's like a thermalization process. You know, you're taking these things that are in sort of non-thermal disk-like orbits, and you have this huge collision, and things just tend to puff out and form something that's much more randomly distributed. If each of these things has a black hole at the core of it, what's going to happen is that you're going to probably end up forming some kind of a binary with these things inside of it. That's one of the things that many of us, myself included, are really interested in this program. And so the real mystery, one of the mysteries, and Marta Voluntari spent a lot of thinking about this, is how does this relationship get enforced through multiple mergers of these processes? Because when these things come together, not only are the black holes colliding with one another, but these galaxies are bringing in a lot of gas. And so you would then ignite a huge epic episode of accretion. So it could be that every time you have a collision like this, this is actually what turns on these quasars that we observe at earlier times. That would be why we actually see them at earlier epochs when collisions like this were much more common. So, I think I've worn out my welcome. I'll end it there.
Is there any way of telling that the thing at the center of our galaxy, if we go up at the center, we get something of our galaxy is out of binary?
Interesting you should ask that. The fact that this object, this particular guy's orbit, is actually about to close and form an ellipse, probably is going to give us our best constraints fairly soon on what the nature of the object at the core actually is. One of the things that people are interested in, I mean, most likely there is not something big down there, because we probably would have already seen its influence. That would have screwed up the tidal field so much that these orbits would have already been somewhat distorted. But an interesting question to ask is, remember, we're barely resolving length scales that are actually much larger than our solar system. People have predicted, because there's a process called mass segregation, in which the largest objects, you tend to essentially equalize their, you can think of them as equalizing their temperatures, and so they tend to have roughly the same velocity, which means the most massive objects will tend to move to smaller radii. You'd expect that any object that was, much larger than these stars would tend to fall down over time into the smallest orbits around these black holes. And so people thought, well, there may actually be like a little mini cluster of compact objects orbiting this black hole. So if that's the case, then this will not have the multiple, it won't be a simple monopole, it'll be something that's kind of fuzzy because of these orbits that are going around it. And so people have begun thinking about whether they can test that fuzziness from this orbit that's closing. One problem is that it takes so damn long for these orbits to close that, it's significant
number of grad student
careers to make progress on some of these questions.
If it was a binary in the radium, wouldn't you see it looking at pulsar time?
That's an excellent point, yeah. So if there was something that was going on down there, something which I didn't mention, is that it's thought, particularly the formation of these binaries, these would be strong generators of gravitational radiation, which is a different talk. But that would cause, there's a potential that if that was the case, that we would see it in timing of highly precise pulsars, because they would essentially have a jitter that was due to the gravitational waves changing the length between us and the pulsar.
Earlier you alluded to alternative or less plausible
right
explanations for these effects. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the kind of things that people put together are essentially condensations of exotic matter. So if you imagine you have some kind of a massive self-interacting scalar field, you can tune the mass and self-interaction parameter such that you get a dark, fairly compact massive object with a mass that is tuned to just about what we see right there. These things are not as they're not as compact as black holes, and so you start to see deviations as you get to smaller and smaller scales. Other things that are popular is people talk about similar models, but it's a fermion, kind of a condensation of fermions of some kind, rather than of some kind of a scalar field. One problem with a lot of these models, in my opinion, is that it's sort of easy to tune the parameters to match one of them. But then, nature needs to, okay, in this galaxy, the ratio of the self-interaction to the mass is X. Here it's, So it's hard to match all the observations.
What's the connection between that collision happening and a change in binary?
So the point is that once a collision happens, you have built a new potential, and you have built a new black hole. So you presumably you started with a galaxy that obeyed this, a galaxy and a black hole that obeyed this relationship, and then after all the shenanigans come to an end, you have a new galaxy that obeys this thing for new different kinds of parameters. What most people now think is that most of the mass that this thing, so you of course imagine that you start out with galaxies that have black holes that are roughly the same mass. When they collide with one another, you're going to get a galaxy or get black holes of roughly twice that mass. That's not quite enough though. You're then going to probably accrete another factor of 3 or 4, say, of the mass due to gas that was brought in by the collision onto this thing. The accretion process also generates enormous amounts of luminosity because of all this energy that's released and winds, and that then kind of back reacts on the structure of the potential, changes the distribution of stars, and it appears to our best guess these days that it sort of then enforces this relationship. This is really, I would say, ongoing stuff, but the picture has become more and more clear over the past few years.
So actually, how accurate is this relationship? Because only it's a statistical statement.
That's right. So with this one, the number that I just pulled out 10 minutes before, prior to coming down here, the claim is that this fit is such that the chi-squared per degree of freedom is about 0.9. So it appears to be, it's a good fit. David, you want to comment?
One of the people who published it.
So.
Well, it depends a lot on which sample you take. If you
right.
The best measured mass is to reduce chi squared, it's like 1, it's almost perfect. But if you include other sort of more questionable masses, it goes up a little bit.
But a big part of this is actually choosing in your sample ones where you're actually, as I mentioned, a big thing that drives this is resolving the cores of these galaxies so you can actually measure these masses accurately. That changes things a lot.
What is the physical meaning of these two coefficients? How can they be determined in the statement? Why is...
So these two coefficients, the mass and this velocity dispersion parameter?
10 to the 8 and 200.
Oh, this is from a... Okay, so... Well, this is just a fiducial value that people choose because it's convenient. It's typical for many of the galaxies that they look at. The interesting thing, the parameters that are determined in the fit are essentially the prefactor. If you take the log of this, and this is a slope and an intercept.
I understand, yeah.
Right? And so that is just... That's what's determined from the data. The thing which I think is most interesting here really is the slope because it's the slope that driving us to this idea that it's sort of feedback from these winds that is driving us to this result.
So if there is this connection between the mass of the black hole at the very center and the ball and all these signals going out there, so you said there has to be some kind of wind, some propagation. Can you see this propagation directly?
So in some of these, yeah, that's what people are looking for, I would say. So Andy Fabian has really gotten, he's definitely gotten a lot of press. He's done a lot of work on looking at the impact of winds. Often these galaxies are actually in clusters. And so what he has seen in some of these, a lot of galaxy clusters themselves contain a lot of free-floating gas, hot ionized gas. And he has seen sound waves, very, very long wavelength sound waves, which he claims are due to these winds essentially causing... You know, they go out, they smack into, in some sense, the atmosphere in these clusters, and they drive sound waves in these things. Yep. Yeah. So if they're going to go, if they're so powerful they go out of the galaxy, they certainly have an impact. They're sort of jetted. I think they have some directionality to them. This is not quite my expertise, but they have definitely... Most people believe that jets are aligned with the spin axis of the black holes. So... No, that's actually that is an important clue that mergers played a big role in these things. So Ann Kinney is one who did the study of this, and she showed that the jets, which are presumed to line up with the spin, absolutely no connection to the plane of the galaxy. Completely random. So that's sort of suggesting that if a galaxy grows through multiple mergers, essentially it randomizes. So it does not have any knowledge as to what the orientation of the galaxy is. Barry?
Are there enough mergers to plausibly build up these supermassive black holes? I remember hearing a while back that it was a big puzzle about how you actually build, a black hole that size.
You have to start with the seed that's big enough to get it going. But Martha, you've done a lot of these things. You want to comment?
Yeah. Well, in principle, you can't have enough mergers if you do not have the initial conditions.
Large enough black holes initially.
And enough, and a lot of them. But then if you make too many, if you use mergers to explain all the black holes that you see today, you don't have any need for accretion from gas. and so quasars, but since you see so many quasars, you cannot make all the black holes. There are some models which explain the information of black holes down up from very small masses, about 3 meters, so it's
work in progress.
If you're going to map ancient quasars into modern galaxies, 1-to-1 or maybe 2-to-1 merger, how short is that making the quasar lifetime in order to have enough quasars?
I'm not sure. What does it turn out to be about? Oh, she wanted to know if we're going to map, if you know, the modern galaxies are fossils of quasars. So in some sense, there's a mapping with mergers going on between the original quasars and the distributions we see today. What does that say about quasar lifetimes?
I mean, it must make them fairly short.
Yeah, I think it must make them fairly short, but I think you can still...
The shortest you can make them is a few million years. Less than a solar system, within the mass of a tiny black hole, typically 10 to the 7
years. Yeah.
I want to say, like, when we have these mergers taking place, the relaxation time for the two black holes in the center, does that give us enough time for these merged galaxies to actually become close enough that we wouldn't observe two orbiting black holes?
So, again, very open questions. This is things that people have spent a lot of time thinking about. The process, so if I have... if I have a pair of galaxies that... and merge like this.
Now you can see sort of
step one in the process is the galaxies come together, and after some dynamics, they form some kind of a merged object. They presumably have black holes at their cores. Those black holes will, through a process called dynamical friction, which essentially is it's a dissipative process because the black hole is being acted on by so many billions of discrete gravitating sources.
They will tend to
sink and form a bound object. And that bound object, if you just use ordinary Newtonian gravity, you'll find this thing is it's fairly widely separated.
It tends to be separated
by distances and scales of
parts, say tens
of light years. It needs to harden, needs to actually lose a lot of orbital energy and be driven into a closer configuration before the relativistic effect of radiation emission will cause it to merge together. David Merritt and Milos Milosavljevic have done a lot of work on this issue. The way it actually hardens is by interacting with all the other stars in the galaxies. Essentially, if you imagine you have a binary, and a star comes in and interacts with that binary, that star will extract kinetic energy from the binary and be flung out at high velocities. This is the same process by which the Voyager probes were sent out of the solar system, by interacting with the Sun-Jupiter binary. They made Jupiter fall towards the Sun slightly in order to be flung out of the solar system. That happens enough times, this binary will harden and presumably get to the point where these black holes are close to one another, that they become strong generators of radiation, they will merge on a relatively short time scale. A lot of work has gone into whether there, in some sense, are enough stars to do this. What happened in some of the first calculations was you found that you actually ran out of stars and you had just a stalled binary that was present there. And that actually was in accord with some observations which showed that the most massive galaxies, those that presumably had the most mergers, actually appear to have a depleted region of stars in, towards their cores. So there was some nice consistency there with that. But what they found is that in galaxies that have more realistically shaped potentials, you essentially don't run out of stars in those cases. Other work by Priya Natarajan and Phil Armitage has just shown that gas that comes in can actually speed the merger process. And so I can't remember exactly what your original question was asking, but the time scale is reasonable. That's right. That's right. It's been tiring. Yeah.
When two galaxies come together like this, is there some probability that one of the black holes will be flung out into space?
So if you just have two of them, no, because two black holes is just at the bound process. Suppose you do get a stalled binary, and you have some galaxy with a binary black hole at the core that's just orbiting happily, and then another merger happens. Then you can have a third body. You have an interaction between three different black holes, and the three body process in Newtonian gravity, as we know, it leads to this same kind of slingshot interaction. And so in that case, you could presumably fling a black hole out of the galaxy.
Wait, is this the same with the Rock effect?
I was about to actually get to that. The one thing which Omar reminded me of, it's my own work.
Yeah.
which is that in the final merger, if you do just have two bodies like this, the black holes merge with one another, most binaries are asymmetric. One body is more massive than the other. And what that means is that their final gravitational radiation pattern will also be asymmetric. And that leads to an actual ejection of linear momentum from the system. So the system receives a kick when the black hole merges just from asymmetric radiation of gravitational waves. And in some work that I did a couple years ago and that sparked a lot of work that has basically improve the error bars really, really nicely. We sort of found that the ballpark velocities you can expect in that case are on the order of 100 to 200 kilometers per second. Big enough that in just the merger of two black holes, you may get things ejected from galaxies on the small side. In the larger ones, though, you definitely won't. It's enough that it might slosh around and sort of stir things up, but it won't be ejected. I think the most plausible way to kick something out, especially for these late-type mergers, is if you have a third body come in.
So it's possible that in the galactic space there are sort of runaway black holes zipping around?
Possibly, yeah.
On very general grounds, do you describe these systems by some kind of Hamiltonian dynamics, or should we think of dynamics that contains dissipative terms?
Which systems in particular are you thinking of?
When you show these pictures, like what we just had with these merging galaxies.
With emerging galaxies, those are done largely just they're n-body codes, so they're just solving
Hamiltonian types of dynamics then. Conserving everything.
That's right. Yeah.
No dissipative.
That's right. I mean, there's often numerical dissipation that enters into this thing just by, and you know, you may put things like that into control numerical instabilities, but in principle, it's just a purely Hamiltonian evolution.
What's the role of dark matter in all of this?
Well, in these simulations, so for instance, in this video, all I'm actually showing is dark matter. Okay, so this is in the merger of the galaxy when this comes in. It's definitely present there, but usually these are things that are happening within the dark matter halo. And so I think on the smallest scales you kind of decouple from that, but on the larger scales it drives everything. I'm tired.